You know, emotional intelligence, it's so important for our leadership, for our health and well-being. And it's kind of robbed from a lot of men because they weren't raised to think that that's something they can focus on.
Welcome to the Emotional Intelligence Podcast, a podcast where we explore the intersection of emotional intelligence and leadership. And whether you're a seasoned executive or just starting out in your leadership journey, we're going to share practical tips, inspiring stories, and expert insights to help you develop your emotional intelligence and achieve your goals. So sit back, relax, and get ready to take your leadership skills to the next level. I'm Ismail.
And I'm Samir. Welcome, everyone, to the Emotional Intelligence Podcast. Today, Ismail and I are joined by a very special guest, Dr. Kristen Neff, who is the Associate Professor at the University of Texas Austin's Department of Educational Psychology. Dr. Neff is the author of Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself, co-founder of the Nonprofit Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, and she's been credited with conducting the first academic studies on the topic of self-compassion. And Dr. Neff's TED Talk on the topic of self-compassion has nearly 3 million views on YouTube to date. Dr. Neff, we are so pleased to have you with us. Ismail and I are huge fans, and this is such an honor for us.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me.
We're really excited for today's conversation. And, you know, just launching into it, maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself and also defining self-compassion for us and what piqued your curiosity or interest in the topic.
Yeah, so, you know, I got interested in self-compassion by practicing it. It was actually my last year of graduate school at UC Berkeley, and I was going through a really stressful time in my life. And I learned mindfulness meditation to try to help me deal with my stress. And luckily for me, that the course was taught in the tradition of a teacher named Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese teacher who always really emphasized self-compassion. And so the very first night, it took me a while to figure out how to meditate. But the woman leading the course the very first night said, you know, if you're suffering in some way, just actually turn the lens of compassion inward. Give yourself support and kindness and warmth like you would to a good friend. And it never really dawned on me before, like this is something good you could do. So I tried it and I was just so impressed by the immediate difference it made in my ability to cope with all the stress and other difficulties I was having. And so when I got my job at UT Austin, I decided I wanted to study it. I decided I wanted to create a scale to measure it. So I knew that to do that, I would need a really clear operational definition so I could like create items and psychometrically valid and all that stuff. So I decided to define self-compassion as having three core components. So there is the kindness, which in some ways is most self-evident, but I also realized it needs two other things. One is mindfulness. I mean, this is not by accident that I learned about it at the same time I learned mindfulness. Because what happens is when we're in pain, you know, but that and that pain could be because we've made a mistake or we failed or we feel inadequate, or it could just be something in our life, our health, something external. We usually aren't very mindful of it. We do one of two things. Either we ignore it, we stick our head in the sand, or we pretend it's not there, you know, which doesn't really usually help very much. It, you know, if we ignore it, it's just still there. Or we do the opposite. We dive into it. We get sucked into it. We have no perspective. We kind of almost... get lost in it, and we can't help ourselves if we're lost in our pain. So we need the mindfulness to be able to step outside of ourselves and say like, hey, you're having a hard time. You know, what do you need to help? So the mindfulness is necessary. And what I didn't figure out immediately, but then after a while thinking about it, I did, was that it also requires other people. So in other words, compassion is a connected way of being. Actually, the word in Latin, passion, means to suffer, com is with. So there's a sense of connection as opposed to pity. Pity is poor you or poor me. There's a sense of separation from others. Compassion is, hey, we're all human beings. We all struggle. We're all doing the best we can. So part of what makes it self-compassion and one of the things that makes it kind of healthy as opposed to self-pity is saying, I'm a human being doing the best I can. I'm not alone. It's not just me. You know, I'm not perfect. Who is? And that kind of, it's actually a type of wisdom because it's true.
Yeah.
It is true. We're only human. You know, we may not want to think so, but it's true. So that's really the wisdom element. And so once you have all those, so for instance, self-love, why don't I call it self-love? Well, you might be a narcissist and have a lot of self-love. But that's not necessarily healthy, right? So you really need the clarity of the mindfulness, the wisdom and connection to the common humanity, in addition to the kindness and love and care, in my perspective, to be really emotionally intelligent.
Right. What one of the interesting or poignant facts or points that happened with Samir and I when we were looking through some of your material was, I remember he texted me about this, specifically about looking at self-compassion through the lens of as you would for a friend. And that really, really hit home for both Samir and I, because we actually help we help each other with each other's compassion. Uh-huh. And I know Samir is always there for me, and he knows I'm always there for him. But it really, really hit home. That's one of my favorite points that I think will stick with me forever, that you've pointed out.
Yeah, well, in some ways, what defines a friendship is mutual compassion. Like, our, you know, our family members, sometimes we aren't so compassionate to them because, you know, we're stuck with them. They're stuck with us.
Right.
A friend, if we aren't compassionate or if there's not that mutual support, you know, often the friendship won't last. So most, not everyone, but most of us have an experience of compassion, mutual compassion in the context of close friendship, which is great, which means this isn't a new skill. It's not like we need to learn how to be compassionate. Most of us have some experience with it in the context of friendship. All we really have to do is remember to treat ourselves like a friend. And, you know, that's not necessarily easy, but it's not rocket science either. It's
right.
About just giving ourselves permission. And also the effects are the same. I mean, you know, Samir, if you said to Ismail, like, you stupid, lazy cow, something, I don't know, something like that, which you hopefully wouldn't say, obviously not, you would be doing the show together. But, you know, what would be the impact on him? He's like, would that make him think, yeah, you're right. I feel so inspired. I'm going to go out and try harder. And, you know, press him and make it harder for him to do whatever he needs to do. And yet we don't, with ourselves, we kind of think that somehow that's going to make us work, try harder or be a better person.
Yeah.
If we call ourselves names, we think that somehow
it's
virtuous in some way. It's really not. Not only is it painful, it's ineffective. It actually, it's like we're kneecapping ourselves. We're pulling the rug out from underneath ourselves when we criticize ourselves.
It's an interesting point about like motivation. How does self-compassion align with motivation? Let's just say like there's the self-criticism is, some people see that as a motivator, but where does self-compassion come in as the motivation?
Yeah. Well, so actually the number one reason people aren't self-compassionate is they believe in self-criticism as the motivator. And the reason they believe in that is that it kind of works. I mean, maybe you got through like graduate school with self-criticism, you know, it does kind of work, but it works the same way that harsh criticism works to motivate a child. Yeah, you will get compliance, you know, and some people do use harsh criticism or fear as a motivator for children or maybe their students. And so it kind of works. It gets people afraid. They often focus more, but it has all these unintended side effects. Like it causes performance anxiety. Right. And when you're anxious, you don't do as well. It undermines your self-confidence, which means you don't do as well. It creates fear of failure. And when you do fail, you're so freaked out because you feel you're worthless that it's very hard to focus on, well, how do I learn from this situation? And so what the research shows very clearly is that self-compassion is a more effective motivator. So actually, someone brought this up. Well, sometimes we say to our friends, you know, oh, don't worry, it's not a big deal. When it really is, okay? That's not really being a good friend. But sometimes maybe all we want our friend, all we want our friend to do is be nice to us. That's okay. But think of a good coach. If you're a high-level coach and you tell the person you're coaching, is paying you to coach them, oh yeah, it's fine, that was great, but it really wasn't. And it's not helpful, it's not compassionate, it's not kind, it's actually harmful. But so it's constructive criticism. Compassion offers constructive criticism and self-compassion. So if we want to help ourselves, we see clearly, okay, this is not working. This behavior is harmful to myself or others, or it's not effective, whatever it is. And if you care, you're going to want to change. Again, kind of like a parent. You know, hopefully a parent ideally motivates their child with love and constructive criticism. So maybe your child gets a bad grade and, you know, first thing you do is give me a hug. Oh, you must be, you know, just because you got an F doesn't mean you're a failure. It doesn't affect my love for you at all. But a good parent doesn't stop there. A good parent says, hey, I want you to get your grades up because I know you want to go to college and reach your dreams in life. How can I help? You know, how can we figure out what's going not working so well and how we can improve so it's more effective? And that's what self-compassion does. So just to give an example, we just published, I think came out 2 or 3 months ago. It's a new study with NCAA athletes. Now, you know, the stakes are high for college athletes. A lot of them want to go into their pros or their scholarship rides on being part of the college team. You know, they can't be second best. They have to be number one. And so we taught NCAA athletes self-compassion. By the way, we didn't call it self-compassion because, you know, kind of in macho athletic culture, it's like, you know, are they really going to sign up for a course on self-compassion? So we called it inner strength training.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And resilience training.
Brilliant.
And so we taught them how to use self-compassion to imagine that they were their own best coach. Imagine if you had a coach who was just really constructive, supportive, was honest, gave you really good feedback because that's what a good coach does, but didn't do it with shame or, you know, loathing, did it just with constructive, out of care and encouragement. And by the way, we also had the coaches involved. We trained teams and the coaches were included. So, which is great because we really actually changed the culture of the team to understand that constructive criticism, compassionate criticism was actually more effective. And it improved their performance. It actually improved their athletic performance. So, you know, it works. Again, just the way it works with kids, constructive encouragement with a lot of help. We have to give ourselves help. If we care, we'll do what we need to get the help we need to achieve our goals. But when our worth isn't dependent on it, it gives us a lot of freedom. You know, self-criticism is like we're using a carrot and stick, and the carrot is I'll have high self-esteem, and the stick is I'll hate myself. And it, you know, it kind of works, but it's so unnecessary. If you take that out of the picture, I'm unconditionally worthy, then you can do it because you want to. And that actually, in psychology, you probably know this. It's called a growth orientation as opposed to a performance orientation. Mm-hmm. More important than, you know, looking good to others is learning and growing. And that actually is, you know, really important. And it's true, failure is our best teacher. We don't want to admit it, but it's true.
Yeah.
How do we approach failure? We approach it in a constructive, healthy way or in a, you know, unhelpful way, which is just internalizing that failure, which really doesn't, you know, I say it kind of works. I'm not going to pretend it doesn't, but it doesn't have to be so painful. And it's a lot more effective if we do it with kindness.
Yeah. It kind of draws a parallel to a lot of the topics that Ismail and I cover on leadership, right? Like we always say that if you rule with an iron fist and you are not utilizing emotional intelligence, you will likely see some short-term success. Like you will see a group of people respond to you, but over time that trust gets degraded and then they will stop responding to you. That's how, you know, like in coach speak, you lose the locker room, right? Because you're, but if you're using EQ skills and you're being compassionate toward others and compassionate toward your team and building that trust, that's that long-term relationship. And in this case, you're talking about the relationship you have with yourself.
Yeah. Well, there is a work with leaders actually also and shows that people respect compassionate leaders more, people who are self-compassionate and also compassionate to others. So, and maybe you would expect, the compassionate to others, they respect that, but they also respect self-compassion. So let's say you're a leader and maybe you're a pretty good leader, but you know, you're always like, oh, I'm so stupid. I'm an idiot. I can't believe I missed that sales target. You know, people are like, you know, what's up with the boss? You know, it's like, you know, it's not really setting a good, we aren't being a good role model for others. Part of what it means to be a good leader is to be a good role model. And so we, especially out loud, okay, missed the sales target. Well, first of all, you're honoring the pain of that. Oh, you know, so disappointed. Really kind of hurts. Well, you know, it's part of being in business. It's okay. You know, what can we learn from this? Let's use this as an opportunity. Actually, one of the best leaders I know is a man named Kevin, who every single setback, he would say, opportunity for learning. And people got excited about like, how to do things differently. And we model that. it just really, you know, you're raising the emotional intelligence of your team as well as yourself.
I mean, I can vouch for that process firsthand. I always talk about, okay, what is the opportunity? What did we learn from this situation? Right. And it really works. It actually changes people's demeanor. You can see it if it's a video call or in person immediately. Yeah. Because it's about, okay, well, how are we going to, it happened, we're over with that. Now it's like, what are we going to do to make it better next time?
Yeah. But not only the sugarcoating, I mean, it can be a slippery slope, right? So sometimes it can be, that's why self-compassion, the focus on pain and suffering is actually kind of useful, because if you skip over that and it's just like, oh, well, just gloss over it. Let's do positive thinking. Well, the problem with positive thinking is if you made a mistake, you're gonna have to, you need to look at it. You need to feel it, because your body feels it, even if you don't consciously acknowledge it. You need to give yourself some compassion for, wow, that hurt. It doesn't feel good to fail. We got to honor it. Can we look at it? And can we own up to it? You know, I like to say the only way out is through. You can't just gloss over the mistake or pretend it's not there, because that's not really, well, you also may lose learning opportunities. So we go through the mistake, we open to it, we feel the pain of it, we hold ourselves, ouch, that hurt, at the same time that we're thinking, what can we learn? And then actually we can get more learning out of the mistake if we go through it as opposed to glossing over it. It's also more honest, you know?
Yeah.
Honesty is important.
Yeah, absolutely. And being honest with yourself.
Yes.
One, sticking with the topic of self-compassion as a motivator, through your research, and I know you've done dozens of studies over the years, what is the cultural or traditional impact? Like, for example, like, you know, do you see different types of results when you are surveying like a South Asian versus a Caucasian versus African American? Like, we're just interested in understanding, you know, as Ismail and I manage very diverse teams, what are some of those considerations that we should be mindful of?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So there hasn't been a lot of research on cultural differences. There have been some, and it seems to be that universally self-compassion is beneficial. It benefits, you know, no matter where in the world you are. But some cultures promote it more than others. So actually, one of the earliest studies I did, I happened to have a graduate student that was from Thailand, and then another graduate student that was from Taiwan. You know, and some people, you might think, well, you know, self-criticism, there's people are so self-focused and individualistic cultures like the United States, maybe in Asian cultures where it's more interdependent, you know, more collectivistic, maybe you wouldn't see as much self-criticism. My Thai student said, yeah, I don't think so. My Taiwanese student was saying, whoa, we're taught in school that you're supposed to criticize yourself. We actually did a study in all three cultures, Taiwan, you know, undergraduates, Taiwan, the USA, and Thailand. And we found that in Thailand, they did have pretty high levels of self-compassion. And in Taiwan, they had the lowest levels.
Oh, wow.
And Americans were in between, although we did have the highest level of self-esteem. We can come back to the difference between that one in a moment. But in all three cultures, people with more self-compassion and better mental well-being. So, you know, in Thailand, like they take their Buddhism pretty seriously, and it's kind of part of Buddhist culture. And, you know, it's like they meditate is a big part of the culture. Whereas Taiwan, it's more Confucian, like, you know, really work hard, strong work ethic, get things done. And so there are different cultural myths and ideas about self-compassion. So it's more prevalent in some places than others.
If you don't mind elaborating on the self-esteem, self-compassion bit,
And so, like, self-esteem, that is definitely something that you see more, higher self-esteem and more.
Indeed.
In individualistic cultures. Well, except it's kind of funny. It depends what you base it on, right? So, for instance, in East Asian cultures, being humble is really considered a virtue. And most people think they're more humble than others in East Asian culture. So you can use anything. So basically self-esteem is usually comparative to others. Am I better than others to have self-esteem? Am I more humble than others? Am I more attractive than others? Am I more successful than others? So self-esteem is a judgment of worth. The word esteem means a judgment. You know, how much about worth do I esteem or judge myself to have? And again, this is based on comparison to others. It can't be average. If I said, hey, you know, this podcast, yeah, it's average. come on, admit it. You'd be like a little, oh, you know, being average is an insult. We have to be above average just for baseline to feel good about ourselves, yeah. Right? And also it's contingent on success. So in other words, we esteem ourselves positively. We feel good about ourselves when we succeed at, you know, whether it's sports or business, or that we look the way we want, or as popular as we want to be. And we feel bad about ourselves. We don't. So self-esteem is a fair weather friend. It is there for us when things are going well, and it deserts us when things are not going so well. So you might say self-compassion is also a source of self-worth, but it's an unconditional friend because it's not based on like judgments or evaluation. It comes simply from being a human being. In other words, the moment a baby is born, you don't have to go to graduate school to have compassion for a newborn infant, like just naturally, just the very fact that we're human beings doing the best we can, struggling, means we have some intrinsic human value and worth. That's where the worth of self-compassion comes from our humanness. And so that means it's there for us when we need it most, which is when we fail, we make mistakes, or, you know, we're rejected. So, and actually I did one study looking at state self-worth, which is like, how are you feeling about yourself today? We looked at that 12 times over a course of 8 months. And we found that it was self-compassion, not overall level of like self-esteem, that predicted stability and self-worth. So again, it's a more stable source of self-worth than self-esteem.
Yeah. No, I think you put it well, because self-esteem is really like all the external factors that define you and your worth. And that's outside of your control a lot of times, right? So it's a lot more stable to create that healthy relationship with self and have compassion for oneself, because you can control that more, like you said, unconditional. But it doesn't seem like it comes easily, right? There is like a practice behind this.
Well, yeah. So there's a few reasons why it doesn't come easily. I mean, let's face it, it's easier to have compassion for others than ourselves. That's really ubiquitous finding. Most people are more compassionate to others than they are to themselves. So they're both cultural, and I think there are probably some biological reasons. That's why it's a double doozy.
Okay.
So culturally, we don't trust self-compassion. We think it's selfish. We think it's going to undermine our motivation. We think it's self-pity. You know, we think it'll make us weak. So all these are barriers to self-compassion. Very few cultures, or a few, like maybe like a place like Thailand, but most cultures, they don't say, hey, it's great to be self-compassionate. They don't teach you that as a kid. So that's one problem. But there actually may be some evolutionary reasons why. If you look at, for us as individuals, when there's a threat and when we're suffering, right? Remember, compassion is a response to suffering. So if there's pain, emotional and physical pain, it means there's a threat, something's wrong. And so we're programmed by evolution to respond with a threat defense response, fight, flight, or freeze. And the problem is us, we turn that inward. So we fight ourselves, thinking that we'll, like, you know, either beat others to the punch so that it won't hurt as much when they beat us up, or we'll get ourselves in line so we'll avoid the pain. Or we flee into a sense of shame and isolation, or we freeze and we get stuck and we ruminate over and over, right? With, you know, Samir, when Ismail fails, you aren't so personally threatened. So you don't go into fight or flees for him. You're able to use another system that evolved, which is the care system, which mainly evolved to take care of our infants and other group members. This also allowed us to pass our genes on, you know, so the caring is also natural, but it's a little more natural when other people are threatened, we go into the care response to help them. When we're threatened, we go into the fight, flight, or freeze response. And so that's, you know, so in other words, don't beat yourself up. If you beat yourself up, it's natural. You know, there's a lot of reasons why that's the case. But the nice thing is it can be overcome. We have to do a little hack. We have to tap into the care system, which is what happens when you treat yourself like a good friend. You know, you're tapping into the system that's pretty easy to access for our friends and loved ones. And we just do a U-turn and turn that inward.
So is it as simple as literally putting yourself and situation in a friend's shoes and saying, what would I say to them? And just saying that to yourself?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways in. It's really no best way. It's just whatever works for you. Sometimes with enough practice and experience, you can just give yourself compassion. It becomes more habitual, straight to yourself. Or you could imagine, what would I say to a good friend in the exact same situation? and then do a U-turn and say it to yourself. The other way in is you can imagine, you know, what would a good friend or grandparent or someone I know really loves and cares about me say to me? Or maybe even like, what a spiritual figure, what would Jesus say to me? Or what, you know, if you're a religious person, you can use any imaginary source of compassion, or any perceived source of compassion. Imagine, what would this compassionate person or being say to me? And then say that to yourself. And you can also think, what does my higher self say to myself? You know, if you believe that we have all of us have kind of a higher, more spiritual self, you can say, well, what would that part of me say to me? So there's a lot of ways in, but the thing is coming from the perspective of compassion. And the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, because it's all coming, even when you think of what my best friend would say to me, I've internalized the perspective of my best friend in me. So it's still coming from me when I say, what would my best friend say to me, you know, or even if it's the spiritual figure, you've internalized what you think this being would say to me if they were really the spiritual being or a compassionate being. So that's inside of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's just, how do you access it in a way that works for you personally?
Yeah, no, those are like definitely helpful for the folks that are listening and saying, how do I actually start being more self-compassionate with myself? That's very practical.
Maybe you had an English teacher in seventh grade that was just amazing. What would Mr. Andrews say to me? As an English teacher, I loved him. Things like nice. That. Yeah, you know.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. We hope you're enjoying the episode so far. If you want to stay updated on all the latest content and behind-the-scenes action, be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and several other places by using the link in the show notes. And if it's not too much trouble, we'd love for you to leave a review and share this episode with some of your friends. Your support means everything to us, and we can't wait to connect with you online. Now, let's get back to the show.
To segue topics a bit, that a lot of people obviously are struggling with a lot post-COVID, during COVID, is like anxiety, is depression. I mean, obviously it dates back much further than that, but it's become like a pandemic of its own. What is the link between like a lack of self-compassion and these various mental health disorders that you're finding or seeing more and more?
Yeah. So the way I actually conceptualize and measure self-compassion is that it's as goes from it's like a bipolar continuum. At one end is judgment, isolation, and over-identification, or kind of dramatizing with pain. The opposite is kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. So the lack of self-compassion, if you define that as being critical, self-critical, feeling like it's just me, everyone else is leading a perfect life, I'm the only one suffering. And if you tend to like really kind of get lost and ruminate on your negative emotions, without a doubt, a large literature shows that it leads to depression, anxiety, increases stress. It impacts your body. So for instance, it raises cortisol levels. It can, you know, cause inflammation, mm-hmm. lead to, in extreme cases, for instance, heart attacks, lead to depression, you know, anxiety disorders. So really, you might say a root cause of psychopathology, as we call it, you know, the bad mental health stuff, is the lack of self-compassion, or this kind of isolation, over-identification, and shame and self-judgment. So, but what happens is when you, and there's lots of research showing when you do the positive, like, so let's say you're feeling critical, isolated, and you're ruminating, you can just give people like, have them write a letter, a paragraph of being mindful of what you're feeling, right? Write about this and kind of with some spaciousness. Write some words about how the fact you aren't alone anymore. You know, you're not alone anymore. You aren't alone, that this is human. Other people feel this too. And then write some words of kindness as if coming from a good friend. And what it does is it tips the balance. So people become less, they feel less shame. They feel less depressed. They feel less anxious. And it actually works at the level of physiology as well. For instance, it lowers cortisol, increases heart rate variability, which is like a parasympathetic response. So it's actually amazing that the real power of self-compassion is by reducing the negative. When you increase the positive, it reduces the negative. It's really powerful for mental health. And actually what they find is in therapy, actually what, in some ways, what is good therapy? helping people be more self-compassionate. And regardless of your therapeutic technique, whether you're cognitive behavioral or psychoanalytic, if you're a good therapist, at the end of the day, your client will probably have more self-compassion. Even if you never use the word, you know, you've kind of modeled compassion and understanding for their suffering. And that's one of the reasons that therapy helps.
For me personally, whenever I'm struggling, beating myself up, my wife always says the same thing to me. She says, give yourself some grace, you know, and I think about that and I never put that comment together with self-compassion. I just was always like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Okay. I'm going to do that. But it was very isolated to like that one feeling that I had, and I would be able to create some distance from that feeling based on her telling me that in the moment. But I feel like, you know, this whole concept of self-compassion as a mindfulness practice is really powerful to take somebody who's able to give themselves grace in like a very isolated situation and just expand it to like multiple areas of life, you know? And so it's really cool and very powerful.
And what is grace as well? If you think about what is grace, I mean, you conceptualize it a lot of different ways, but if you give yourself grace, probably means you're being pretty aware. There's like light to grace.
Yes.
There's a clear seeing. You feel connected. Grace, yep. I mean, kind of, you know, a spiritual connotation that, you know, we're all human beings, or all one, or part of this greater whole. And there's love and kindness there. Grace also has a warmth to it. So it's a way of almost summing up the three components of self-compassion in that word. If you're, you know, taking a few liberties, but I think that works.
It definitely has like a cathartic impact though, you know, just to do that in those moments.
As we're talking about compassion and, you know, it sounds like it's a very soft approach to it, gentle, but there are two terms that you use, fierce self-compassion and tender self-compassion.
Yeah.
Can you help us, you know, go through some of that?
Yeah. Cause it's not always gentle.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
So think if you're a parent and your kid's running out into the street, you aren't going to like, oh, little child. You know, you're like, grab that kid, get out of the street, you know? So compassion, again, by definition in psychology, is concerned with the alleviation of suffering. So how do we alleviate suffering? So when it comes to how we relate to ourselves or difficult emotions, the best way to alleviate suffering is through acceptance, right? So we accept ourselves. Yes, we're flawed. We're flawed human beings. You know, our emotions, they hurt. We stop fighting them. We kind of embrace them, kind of like a parent with a crying child. We hold ourselves, you know, we soothe ourselves. We start to calm down. And this is a real healing power of self-compassion. But sometimes, you know, it's not just acceptance. We need to take action, like with the example of, you know, pulling your kid out of the street who's running into the street. So sometimes we need to take action to alleviate suffering. And that tends to be more aimed at behaviors. If we're engaged in behaviors that are causing harm to ourselves or others, or if other people are engaged in behaviors that are causing harm to us, or if we're in a situation like a toxic relationship or work environment or something, or something's we're being treated unfairly, sometimes to alleviate our suffering, to care for ourselves, like we need to draw a boundary. We need to say no. We need to speak up. We need to fight for injustice. I mean, I think social justice movements are self-compassion movements. You know, you're not going to treat my group that way. I'm a human being. My rights need to be respected. That is self-compassion right there. You know, really standing up for yourself. And that can be quite fierce. Also, you know, a motivating change in a way that needs action, to take action, to do something. Making sure that our needs count too, that we aren't just giving ourselves away, that we're saying, you know, actually what I want in life is, it's not more important, but it's not less important. You know, I'm going to spend some of my precious time and energy fulfilling myself because I count too. These are all action forms of self-compassion. And so I call them fierce and tender, you know, just as kind of to highlight the energetic difference. Yin and yang is another way you can describe it. It's very similar, you know, yin more the tender, yang more forceful. And, you know, it's interesting. You guys will probably find this interesting. And so my book about fierce self-compassion, I actually wrote it for women in particular. And I kind of feel badly. A lot of people who identify as men say, what about me? I need fierce self-compassion. The reason I did it is because gender role socialization interferes with our ability to balance these two expressions of compassion. And so, and by the way, I'm not talking about biological sex. I'm not talking about gender identity. Maybe you're non-binary or you identify as male or female. It's how you were raised. People who are raised as boys, they're allowed to be fierce. But they aren't allowed to be tender. In fact, people raised as boys often get bullied or picked on if they're too tender or sensitive. And that's why if you come to one of my workshops, you know, less than 20% of the people there identify as male. Because that's not a, you know, that's like a self and like, you know, self-help. Yeah. You know, and that harms, that harms men. Yeah. It's such a powerful coping, you know, emotional intelligence. It's so important for our leadership, for our health and well-being. And it's kind of robbed from a lot of men because they weren't raised to think that that's something they can focus on. But so people raised as girls and women, it's the opposite. You know, there's a little more flexibility in gender roles for girls, but, you know, you can be tender, especially to others, you know, that's fine. But if you're too fierce, if you're too ambitious, if you're too aggressive, you know, we have other words for women that, you know, I don't think Hillary Clinton or in any female politician, there's like, you know, if she's a strong, competent, ambitious woman, then she must not be sweet and nurturing. Therefore, we don't like her.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So like anger, for instance, for women, men are encouraged to be angry. People believe angry men. They think that angry man is passionate. They think an angry woman is crazy. You know, and so for women, because we aren't allowed to be angry, we feel like this outside alien has taken us over. And that means we have a less good relationship with anger. So all these things. So my book is aimed more just because it was too towering to say, well, for people raised as women, it works this way. And for people raised as men, it works that way. So, but everyone needs both. It's like yin and yang. And we need to be balanced. If we're too fierce, we aren't tender enough, then, you know, we're like striving and anxious and stressed. We're mm-hmm. all like, go, go, go. But if we're too tender, not fierce enough, we may be complacent. Maybe I may be on my cushion, you know, yeah, I'm zen, I'm happy. And like, you know, social injustice, global warming's going on and like we aren't doing anything. So we need both. We need to be balanced and integrated in order to be whole.
It sounds like fierce, well, maybe you can help me clarify, but fierce is almost like taking action.
Yes.
And tender is maybe taking a moment or
yes,
pausing.
Yes, acceptance. Yeah. And so it's not 100%, but usually the acceptance of ourselves as people, accepting ourselves and our emotions, and typically the action is taken toward behaviors or situations. So I can say, again, maybe if I'm failing math, that's a behavior and I need to change it. And the behavior actually isn't acceptable because I don't want to fail math and, you know, I want to go to college, but I'm still acceptable. So we can accept ourselves, even though our behaviors, we try to change, you know, or the situation, you know, maybe I'm working three jobs and it's not, whatever it is.
For a leader, let's say for, you know, in a leader in a work environment, it sounds like they need to have the ability to be switching between that fierce and tender self-compassion regularly to be a strong leader. And I think we see that female leaders may struggle with that more or male leaders. What do you see more there?
It's kind of interesting. If you look at traditional gender role stereotypes, they really map onto these because traditionally women are supposed to be communal, which is tender, and men are supposed to be agentic, which is fierce, right? And the research shows that female leaders who are androgynous, meaning not like gender, like the way they look, but who display both agentic and communal traits, they do okay. But if they're one or the other, they don't do so well. Male leaders, they can be either. They can either just be agentic, no communal, and they still do okay, actually. Or they can be both and they can be okay. But leaders, especially the soft skills like management, actually benefits from having both agency and communion. And you don't even have to toggle back and forth. Joan Halifax has a great saying. We need a strong back and a soft front. So at the same time, so it's like I'm strong, I'm resolute, I'm not going to be pushed around, I'm clear, I'm going to speak up, but I'm not going to like dehumanize anyone. I don't need to cut anyone down. I can still be caring. You know, so they actually, ideally, they're merged and integrated. It's like a tree, you know, solid trunk, but flexible branches at the same time. takes a little work.
I love that.
I've been a practice designed to like help people integrate.
I mean, there are some things probably that both Samir and I do, because I know Samir, I've seen you do this yourself, but that we both do that probably very line up very closely to this strong back, soft front. I mean, I will say I'm critical of myself when I say like, you know what? I don't want to cut that person down. I don't think they deserve that. They deserve help. They deserve, and I look at other people, like the majority of the population, say my peers or competition, they're not like that at all. But then
that's why it's just you, Ismail.
It's just me.
But it's just you. You're the only one.
I dip into my personal values actually at that point. Yeah. And that's how I reinforce my decision. But like you still see, and you may, I think you did clarify this, but you see people who are, I think you use the term agentic, but like they're male leaders, harsh and just firm. And you wonder, well, they've made it up to the top. How am I supposed to do that as a self-compassionate leader?
Yeah. So, I mean, so being cutthroat and ruthless and not caring about people. So again, it kind of works, just like, criticism kind of works, but there are unintended consequences like happiness, you know, your blood pressure.
Yes, this is true.
And you don't have to be that way, right? So if you have the soft front and really, again, think of it might be hard when it comes to you're really sticking to your goals. You know, second best is second best isn't enough in terms of your goals. You can be that way. But if you come in second, it doesn't mean that you're less worthy. See, that's the thing. That's where the softness comes in. I am unconditionally worthy, even though my goal is to like be number one. And if I'm number two, it's not acceptable. Like those athletes, it's not okay. The behavior isn't okay. It's not good enough, but I'm good enough. So it kind of, you know, you have to be a little wise in terms of how you're relating to what's happened. You can like be really strong and determined and goal oriented and still care about yourself. And in fact, that the goal orientation can come from care. Why do I want to be number one? Why do I want to make the $1 billion? If you want to make the $1 billion so that you're a worthy person, you know, then that's kind of going to be a little iffy, because what happens if you lose it? Or, you know, but if you want to make the $1 billion because you've got these amazing dreams and you want to, I don't know, change global warming or do something like that, you can still go for that $1 billion. But your worth isn't contingent on it. And that actually gives you more freedom. See, when your sense of worth is linked to your goal, if your self-worth is contingent on it, then you have like multiple avenues to get there. The stakes aren't as high. And then this is where values comes in. Why am I going for that goal? Am I going for that goal to feel good about myself? Well, no, because I already feel good about myself. Okay, then I'm only going to go for the goals that are deeply personally meaningful. And then meaningful goals have a lot of advantages in that, you know, that kind of you're more motivated for meaningful goals. If you get a setback, you have more grit, you've got more perseverance. You know, so really, I think for leaders, having this ambition and motivation coming from love rather than fear is really what, you know, kind of a poetic way of saying it, is actually more effective for yourself and for others. But it doesn't mean you got to be squishy and be second best, and not at all. Because if you care, then that's not compassionate if it's important to you to just slide.
I like that. Now that's a really important distinction. And so one of the things, like kind of in the same vein, is I wanted you to expand a little bit about, like, and you talked about it on the fierce self-compassion. Just sometimes you have to be like, hey man, we got to get up and do this, you know? Yeah. But like, how do you balance, like, or how would you explain the relationship between self-compassion and discipline, right? Because that's something that I hold very closely to myself. It's like, I got to be disciplined, and I got to, you know, make sure I get to the gym when I set out, get there. I got to make sure that I'm doing the things that I set out to do. And if I am not doing it, then I'm not being disciplined. I'm being weak. And that's where I think a lot of my, I know this is turning into a Samir therapy session, but my self-compassion really struggles is when I'm trying to be disciplined, it's very hard for me to be self-compassion because I feel like I'm being weak. So what are your thoughts on that?
So it's really just a matter of why are you being disciplined? You know, why, which means for you getting going to the gym, right? So if you, and you can use that as a motivator. If I don't go to the gym, I'm going to basically call myself names and it's going to make me feel bad. So it kind of works. But another way you could do it is I want to go to the gym because I'm going to feel so good. And if I don't, then my body will hurt. And I care about myself and, you know, and I want to be healthy and I want to be good in my body. And, you know, and that way, so your self-worth isn't contingent on it, but it can be just as powerful of a motivator. As saying, I'm going to call myself like a weakling if I don't do it. Like, I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to feel good in my body. I'm going to feel healthy. I'm not going to, you know, have whatever negative health effects that I'm afraid of if I don't go to the gym. There's a lot of research on self-compassion and procrastination, which is kind of the flip side of people who aren't disciplined. And it reduces procrastination. Because what happens is if you start like, you know, kind of threatening yourself, if you don't do it, then you don't really want to think about it because it's associated with like, oh, now going to the gym is a chore. So I don't want to think about it. So, oh yes, I'd be happy to help you with your project, which means I'm not going to have to go to the gym.
Yeah.
So you start procrastinating partly as a way to avoid the negative emotions that you've attached to your goal through like threatening self-criticism. And so it's actually easier to just do it and you don't have to procrastinate because, yeah, if I fail, it's no big deal. So I'm going to really try to go to the gym. If I don't get to the gym, it doesn't mean I'm a failure, but I really want to. That means I can keep my goal. I can keep my eye on the prize. I don't have to distract myself from it because it's not that painful. If you're a parent, it's best. If you're a parent, you've got kids that you love, you understand what this feels like. That you want the best, not all parents are this way, but hopefully you want the best for your child, not so that you love them more, but because you love them. It's like your love isn't contingent on them doing well. You want them to do well because you love them. That's where it comes from. That's where your inspiration comes from. That's where your care comes from. You want to help. You want to do everything you can to help your child. Ideally, not all parents are like that, but ideally, and we know the motivational power of love. It can be, you know, it can move mountains.
Ismail and I can both attest to that as parents ourselves. One thing I have to ask is if somebody is completely wired to be a self criticizer, right? There's somebody who just like has like a very strong inner voice of like, you're not good enough, you haven't accomplished enough, you're just not worthy. Like, what steps would you recommend a person like that who's just completely wired that way to flip that switch and go into a self-compassionate self-talk and like just to do a wholesale change? Because I do think it's, you know, somebody who does struggle with this, like I think that it would be so much more healthy to be on the other side of it. But how would one go about doing that?
Yeah, well, and so first of all, there are some probably brain differences in the tendency towards self-criticism. And absolutely, early childhood upbringing creates a lot of differences. You know, whether your parents were self-critical or they are critical towards you, or it's very stressful and you experienced maybe a lot of trauma or threat, you're going to be more self-critical. So again, number one rule, don't beat yourself up for beating yourself up. Because actually this voice, remember, you're trying to protect yourself. The inner critic, this voice, even though it hurts and even though it may not be very effective, the underlying motivation is self-preservation. So it actually is a form of care. So just have to remember that. And you can actually do a couple of things. First, give yourself compassion for the pain of the self-criticism. You didn't choose to be a self-critic. It's not like someone said, hey, okay, we can give you a brain or give you an upbringing, you know. Okay, I'll choose the intense self-criticism. You didn't choose it. You know, so be compassionate about it, kind of, you know, get in touch with the pain of it. Kind of, oh, it's hard to be a self-critic. I didn't choose it, but here we go, and ouch, you know. But you can also, this is amazing, give compassion to the part of you that's self-critical, and even some gratitude. Thank you for trying to keep me safe. And so like the voice, you know, we have different parts of ourselves. We have part of ourselves that tends to be critical, part of ourselves that's more compassionate, part of ourselves who are like managers and solve problems. So when that voice comes up, you can say, you know, it's funny, my son had that voice come up and we did some CBT therapy. We had a script saying, tricky brain, thank you so much for trying to keep me safe, but you're actually not helping very much right now. He's autistic. So he would have him say that to himself. But anyone could say that, you know, tricky. Thank you so much for trying to keep me safe, but it's actually not helping very much right now. You know, and so that way the voice may still speak, but you don't have to listen to it that strongly. You don't have to be mean to it, but you can say, oh, thank you, but you know, maybe not right now, you know, but I got the point, heard you, problem, I got a problem, yeah. Okay, heard you, got the message. What happens if we shut ourselves, if we shut our inner critic down or we shame ourselves for inner criticism, that part of ourselves says, you know, he hasn't gotten the message, I better scream louder. And then like takes over the system to make sure you get the signal. Because remember, it's a fear signal. It's a danger signal. The inner critic is trying to warn us of a danger because it's really, this part of us that's frightened. So, how sweet. There's a part of me that cares about me so much, wants me to be afraid, not to be worried, you know, not to have this danger. Thank you. But I think I'll listen to the other part of me that actually is probably a little more mature and maybe a little more capable of seeing the complexities of the situation. Our inner critic is like black and white, simplistic. Whereas you might think of my wise inner coach, who's very knowledgeable and, you know, can see things clearly in complexity, and you have something else to say.
It's fascinating how the end is so simple. Like after you explain it and get to the end, you're like, oh, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But there's so many interconnected steps along the way. I mean, I know that I've been given very specific advice. The way that you described it is if something happens to you, and most people are like, why did this happen to me?
Yeah.
Versus saying, well, thank you for making this decision for me. Thank you for making this decision easier for me. And I, you know, until I started looking at it that way, I felt like a victim.
Yeah.
Now I'm more empowered and saying like, oh, okay, that's one less thing I have to worry about, or, you know, check that off the list and I can move forward.
So it is lots of little steps. It's a lot to think about in some ways, but in the other sense, it's very, very simple. It's a matter of opening your heart. I mean, really, it just comes down to, you can almost just pause. What happens if I just open my heart and just kind of tune in? And then it all kind of falls into place.
Do you find that the simplicity of it causes resistance? Like people think, oh, that's too easy. So it's got to be harder than that.
Yeah. So that's the tricky brain again. So we have called the manager parts. We have parts of us that are very identified with the sense of being the problem solver, like the intellectual problem solver. To be meaningful, it must be very complicated and take a lot of steps to think about, and certainly not as simple as just open your heart. You know, that part of us is like, what's she talking about? And right. So in a way, there's a bit of a surrender when we kind of just open our heart. What we're doing, and this is where self-compassion in a way starts being a spiritual practice, is we're kind of letting go of that sense of rigid, rational, separate self who's a problem solver, and it's like a very small self. And we're opening to kind of the wider field of love and care and connection and presence. And there's the part of us gets a little frightened by that. And that's why we got to make sure that we love all parts of ourselves, including our tricky brains that are trying to keep safe, you know, our problem-solving parts, our intellect.
I love the term surrender because even, you know, some people will look at it in a negative connotation, but I just like it in the terms of just like, you know, relaxing your body and letting things happen as they may, which, I mean, 9 times out of 10 we'll say are going to be fine. Like it's the right way to go, the right path.
And if it does take actions, and that is the fear self-compassion, you're doing it instead of like feeling like I am controlling everything and doing it. It's like, love is doing it. Awareness is doing it. You know, I'm doing it because it's the thing to do. Yeah, you know, it's the right thing to do. You aren't taking it so personally. But you might take real, I mean, look at someone like, you know, Martin Luther King or Gandhi or all the great social justice leaders. They made incredible change, but they did it with love in their hearts. You know, so it doesn't mean that you can be surrendered to love and still take fierce action, but the reasons for it are coming from connection and care as opposed to, you know, selfish or egoic reasons.
I mean, there's so many different things that I think we could dive deeper into.
Quite take hours.
Yes, I think it's fantastic, and I'm so grateful that that you're doing this work and that we're able to learn from it, and hopefully our audience as well. Would it be possible? Usually, we'll stop and actually ask a very specific question, but what we wanted to do is take an opportunity, and if you could help us go through one of your self-compassion breaks. To end us off, that'd be great.
Yes, absolutely. So the self-compassion break, and it's called a break because it only takes about 5 minutes. You can do it, you know, take just like you take a coffee break. You can take a break from your normal way of relating to things and just take 5 minutes out to bring self-compassion to whatever you're struggling with. It could be an emotional difficulty. It could be physical discomfort. And it's very easy. It just involves bringing in the three components of self-compassion, usually starting with mindfulness, being mindful of what's happening, remembering common humanity. We aren't alone. It's not just us. And then bringing in some words of kindness. So yeah, I'll lead you through this. You can do this with your eyes open or eyes closed. I tend to prefer my eyes closed, so I'm going to close my eyes. So but it helps to go inward when you close your eyes, I find.
Yeah. I think I'm going to take my glasses off and close my
eyes. Closing your eyes, and just if you want, or at least looking downward, and just settling into your body for a moment. Okay, maybe just take a deep breath. We've just been talking a lot, letting out some of that talking. Okay. So I'd invite you to think about something that's happening in your life right now that's difficult or challenging. So this might be a health issue you're dealing with, or maybe there's some stressor in your life. Maybe you're having an issue at work or at home. Please don't think about something that's really overwhelming, because you'll get lost in the story and you won't be able to do the practice. So something that's mild to moderately challenging or difficult. And maybe you're feeling badly about yourself in some way, a mistake you've made. Just whatever feels right to work with. Okay, and so just take a moment to call the situation to mind. What's happening? What's going on? And it should feel a little uncomfortable when you think about this, but not overwhelmingly so. Okay, so the first thing you want to do is bring in some mindfulness. So just using mindful awareness to see, to be present with the fact that this is really hard. You know, this, what I'm going through right now, it's difficult. It's challenging. It hurts. Whatever the cause, it hurts. But also remembering common humanity. In other words, there's nothing wrong with you for having something like this happen. It's very human. You certainly aren't the only one who's going through a situation like this. You may just take a moment to think about that fact. There's probably, you know, hundreds and thousands of people dealing with something similar. Not to belittle what you're going through, but just to really acknowledge, you know, this is actually what connects you to others. It doesn't isolate you or separate you from others. And then finally, let's bring some kindness to ourselves, because we're struggling. And so one way to do that might be through physical touch, maybe putting both hands over the center of your chest or over your heart center, right? If that feels comfortable, or maybe your face, or just even holding your hands, but some sort of physical touch to let your body know you're there for yourself, you care. And then saying some words of kindness and support, you know, the type of thing you would say to a good friend who is in a similar situation as you. And if you want, you can think, you know, what would you say if you had a good friend who was going through the same situation? Or what would that good friend say to you? Right? And so and seeing if you can say some words of warmth, encouragement, understanding, support. You know, depending on your situation, it may be something like, you know, it's okay to make mistakes. Or, you know, this will pass. Or, how can I help? I'm here for you. Or, you know, you're doing the best you can. Or maybe just something like, I'm so sorry you're going through this. Whatever feels appropriate. You know, what do you need to hear right now that will help you through get through this? Give yourself permission to say it to yourself. And also, it may be a little fierce, like maybe you need to do something. So allow for that possibility as well. What do you need to hear? Okay, so you can let go of the practice. It's funny, it doesn't take long, but it just shifts your perspective on things in a way that makes a real big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Kristen. We really appreciated your time on the show today. You are absolutely welcome back anytime, but we will, you know, we'll link to Dr. Neff's website and her social media handles in our show notes, so you guys can connect with her in different ways. And you know, she has a ton of really, really awesome videos and things on YouTube, different podcasts that she's been on. So there's a lot out there. So if you want to hear more from Dr. Neff or about Dr. Neff, there's a lot of things out there that we will link to in the show notes.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of the Emotional Intelligence Podcast. We hope you found it informative and enjoyable. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave a review on your favorite platform. Your feedback helps us improve and reach more people. If you're interested in learning more about the topics we discussed today, be sure to check out the show notes for links and resources. You can find them by visiting our website. And if you have any questions or feedback, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us by email at info@emotionalintelligence.com or connect with us on social media by using the links in the show notes.